And the worship and your gracious hospitality. And we've studied a diversity of topics. We've looked at Jesus' ethic, very important subject. We've looked at God's plan for marriage. And today I want us to look at yet another topic, God's plan in the New Testament pattern of church government. All these topics, as I mentioned at the beginning, have one thing in common, the conviction that it is the scriptures that are our sole authority and our common foundation. And this is a topic that has generated a lot of discussion and some controversy even in our circles in recent years. And I certainly offer the following reflections with humility, in no way claiming that this is the final word on the subject, but once again, as a biblical scholar and as a New Testament scholar, my quest is simply to do my best to see what Scripture has to say on any topic, including this very important topic. So again, if you have your Bibles with you today, you may want to turn to 1 Timothy. And I will go over some of the relevant passages in a moment, especially 1 Timothy chapter 3 and several other passages along the way. Let's talk about the New Testament pattern of church government. Ecclesiology has always been an important issue in Baptist discussion. In fact, the argument has been made that this is the theological area in which Baptists have made the most important, or at least one of the most important contributions, particularly in the area of requiring a regenerate church membership. The past few years have witnessed a veritable avalanche of publications in the area of ecclesiology, and especially the issue of church government, for the most part written by Baptist scholars. Gerald Cohen, one of my colleagues, has posed the question, title of his book, Who Rules the Church? Zondervan published a Four Views book entitled Who Runs the Church? Similar titles, which includes a contribution by Paige Patterson. Chad Brand and Stan Norman, professors at Southern and New Orleans Seminary respectively, edited a very similar volume, Perspectives on Church Government, Five Views of Church Polity, with contributions by Daniel Aiken, my own president, and others. Both the Midwestern Journal of Theology and the Southern Baptist Journal of Theology devoted entire and recent issues to the subject. Southern Seminary student Ben Merkel contributed a published dissertation, The Elder and Overseer, One Office in the Early Church. Mark Dever, pastor of Capitol Hill Baptist Church in Washington, D.C., has spoken out consistently on the topic of church government, most notably in his Nine Marks of a Healthy Church. The most recent contribution comes from Phil Newton, senior pastor at Southwoods Baptist Church in Memphis, Tennessee, and is entitled Elders in Congregational Life, Rediscovering the Biblical Model for Church Leadership. If you thought veritable avalanche was an exaggeration, perhaps after this list of titles, all published within the last 5 years, you will agree that there have been few topics that have been the subject of more vigorous discussion in Baptist life than the issue of church government in general and of elders in particular. It is clearly impossible for me in the short span of 30 minutes or so to do justice to the complexity of the topic and to consider adequately all the many pros and cons for the various positions on church government, elder rule, and so on, even within our Southern Baptist circles. Rather than deal with all the various exigencies and practical issues surrounding those matters, I propose to address the biblical data as a New Testament scholar who's recently had occasion to work through the pastoral epistles in my work on the forthcoming revised edition of the Expositor's Bible Commentary. While issues of application may change, the biblical data do not, and perhaps by revisiting scriptural teaching on the subject, we will be able to clarify our own thinking on some of those issues and find new common ground on this hotly debated matter. elders and overseers first then. The area of church leadership is one area where the pastoral epistles quite clearly set forth paradigms for the church that reached beyond their original Ephesian or Cretan context. Even those who vigorously dispute that Paul's teaching on women's roles in the church in 1 Timothy 2, 12 through 15 is normative for today, regularly, although inconsistently, award binding status to the qualifications for church leaders in 1 Timothy 3. In the following remarks, we'll deal with several disputed areas in recent discussion on the pastoral's teaching on church government. To begin with, it has been claimed by some that the church structure found in the pastorals reflects the second century pattern of a three-tiered ecclesiastical hierarchy involving a monarchical episcopate, such as Ignatius of Antioch. Yet closer scrutiny reveals that the pastorals do not in fact conform to this model, but rather display synonymous usage of the terms overseer, episkopos, and elder, presbyteros, as referring to one and the same office. And there's a parallel usage of those two terms in Titus 1, 5, and 7, Acts 20, 17, and 28, and several other passages. With regard to specific terminology, 1 Timothy 3, 1 uses the word episcopae, denoting the office of overseer, while in 1 Timothy 3, 2, the following verse, episkopos is found, referring to the person holding such an office. In the Septuagint, the term designates one in charge of an operation. In Josephus, it denotes an overseer. The Qumran equivalent was the mebaker. Generally, presbyteros is Jewish in origin, signifying seniority, elder, while episkopos is Greek, indicating a person's superintending role. Presumably, overseers constituted the board of elders, Greek presbyterion, mentioned in 1 Timothy 4:14. The overseer, equivalent to pastor-elder, bears ultimate responsibility for the church before God. According to the instructions on the role of women in the previous chapter, especially 1 Timothy 2:12, only men are eligible for this office. This is confirmed by the qualification, mias, gynaikos, andra, husband of one wife, in 1 Timothy 3:2. But what does this phrase mean? What are the exegetical options for the respective positions? How strong is the supporting evidence for each of the views? And which option is the most plausible? The mias gynaikos andra requirement. English translations as well as commentators differ considerably regarding the meaning of that phrase in 1 Timothy 3, 2, and 12. There's at least five major options that are all held by various commentators. First, does Paul here require church leaders to be married, which would exclude unmarried office holders? Two, is he seeking to prohibit applicants who are divorced? Three, does the requirement bar widowers who remarried from holding ecclesiastical office? NRSV translates it this way, for example. Four, does the apostle speak out against polygamy, as seems to be implied in the NIV? Five, or is he requiring that an office holder be faithful in marriage if he is, and assuming that he usually is, in fact married, as opposed to being unfaithful to his wife while being married to her, as would be the case if he had one or several extramarital affairs, which was often the case in the ancient world in the form of concubinage. Virtually all of these positions are taken by at least certain translations and or commentators. How can this difficult issue be satisfactorily resolved, and which interpretation is most likely in light of the meaning of the phrase and the ancient cultural background? To begin with, first, it is unlikely that Paul, who himself was unmarried throughout most, if not all, his apostolic career, see 1 Corinthians 7:8, I wish that many were single just as I am, and who elsewhere extols the advantages of singleness for kingdom service, 1 Corinthians 7:32 through 35, would exclude single men from holding ecclesiastical office. Also, if the apostle's intention had been to limit the holding of church offices to those who are married, he could have said so much more unequivocally, such as by listing as a requirement that overseers be married, Greek word gamos. It is therefore highly probable that the present requirement simply assumes that most potentially qualified candidates would likely be married, and hence addresses a man's conduct toward his wife in marriage. Second, if it had been Paul's intent to exclude divorcees, one can once again think of more direct ways in which the apostle may have articulated this requirement, such as not divorced. At least on the face of it, this can at best be considered a possible inference from the wording husband of one wife rather than a direct statement. In fact, divorce is not mentioned anywhere in all of the pastoral epistles, neither is remarriage. Third, it is also unlikely that Paul sought to prohibit widowers who remarried from church office, who by literal reading would in that case have been married not once but twice or more often. The apostle elsewhere encourages those who are widowed to remarry and adopts an entirely positive stance toward those who have lost their spouses. It would be hard to understand why Paul would bar widowers who follow his advice and remarry from church office. This is true especially since many of these persons would be older, mature men who command respect and possess the life experience and spiritual seasoning to provide competent and distinguished leadership in the church. In the case of widowers who remarry, remarriage does not imply any character flaw or moral failure on their part, nor does the presence of a new wife constitute an obstacle to such a man's eligibility, since he would be no different from other married men who seek and hold church office. There seems, therefore, to be no biblical, theological, or even common sense reason why remarried widowers should be barred from church office. Interestingly, that has not kept many in the early church and the church fathers from holding to this interpretation, which proves that the church fathers, in my view, didn't always get it right. Fourth, the theory that Paul sought to exclude polygamists from holding church office runs into the difficulty that polygamy was not widely practiced in the Greco-Roman world at that time. Considerably more likely is the possibility that the phrase mias gynaikas andra is geared toward barring men from holding church office who had one or several concubines of widespread practice at that time. Apparently, neither the Greeks nor the Romans regarded these practices as adulterous or polygamous. For Paul, however, concubinage was essentially equivalent to polygamy, since sexual union results in a one-flesh relationship. Compare 1 Corinthians 6:16. For this reason, faithful husband is probably the best way to capture the essence of the expression mias gynaikas andra. That the phrase constitutes a reference to marital faithfulness is suggested by the parallel in 1 Timothy 5:9, where a widow eligible for church support is required to have been faithful to her husband, the exact same converse phrase, and where the equivalent phrase, wife of one husband, is used. In the latter instance, the phrase cannot indicate a prohibition of polyandry being married to more than one husband at a time, which in any case was virtually non-existent in the ancient world, since it is made of a woman bereft of her husband. Moreover, it would hardly make sense for Paul first to encourage younger widows to get remarried and then disqualify them later on the grounds that they have literally been wives of more than one husband. On a different note, the present requirement of marital faithfulness for church leaders, which includes deacons, 1 Timothy 3:12, is also consistent with the prohibition of adultery in the Decalogue. If this discussion is on target, therefore, it seems that the problem with the first four interpretations is that they're based on a literalistic, if not rigid, reading of the phrase mias gynaikas andras as denoting literally marriage to only one woman ever. One, as opposed to zero, as in the case of single candidates for church office, or one, as opposed to two or more wives, be it at the same time, polygamy, or consecutively, remarriage of widowers or divorcees. More likely, however, the phrase is to be understood idiomatically, designating a one-wife type of husband, that is, as a term for marital faithfulness, rather than as a literal enumeration of a certain number of marriages, one rather than zero, or two or more, in which a candidate is required to be engaged. That this is in fact the case is further supported by inscriptional evidence regarding the Roman concept of a univira, that is, a one-husband type of wife. This term denoting marital fidelity was initially applied to living women in relation to their husbands and later became an epithet given by husbands to their deceased wives. This is attested by numerous extant literary references and tombstone inscriptions. Hence, the first century BC poet Catullus wrote, "To live content with one man is for wives an honor of honors. The Roman imperial inscription reads, she lived 50 years and was satisfied with one husband. The late 1st century BC Laudatio Turiae records the husband saying about his wife, rare are marriages so long-lasting and any badess not interrupted by divorce. For these reasons, we conclude that the Pauline Mias Gynaikos honorary requirement is best understood as stipulating that candidates for church office, both elder and deacon, be faithful husbands, assuming that they're currently married. And incidentally, for that reason, sometimes a formal equivalence translation, such as the New American Standard Bible, just rendering it word by word, husband of one wife, in my view, is not as helpful as, in this case, an idiomatic rendering. By all means, if we have an idiom in the Greek, we ought to render it idiomatically, regardless of our translation philosophy. If this is correct, what then are the implications of this requirement for the church today? In the following discussion, we will briefly consider the implications of this requirement for single, divorced, and remarried candidates for church leadership. The first implication is that younger candidates who have yet to prove their ability to manage their own household well should ordinarily not be put in ultimate leadership positions in the church. While they may possess proper formal training as well as be both eager and otherwise qualified in terms of character and disposition, maturity and life experience are such an integral part of a church leader's necessary equipment for his role that any diminishing of this requirement may come dangerously close to appointing a recent convert, which is discouraged in Scripture in the strongest terms, 1 Timothy 3:6 and 5:22. Second, it is utter folly for someone to provide qualified, capable leadership for the church while neglecting his duties to his own family, be it owing to busyness in ministry or to improper priorities. Even while serving as pastor or elder, it is therefore imperative that men serving in this function regularly evaluate themselves to see whether or not they're able to oversee the church while continuing to be able to adequately fulfill their natural duties as husband and father. Otherwise, it may well be said with Paul that those men beware lest possibly, after having preached to others, they may themselves be disqualified, 1 Corinthians 9:27. Third, theologically, by linking the family so closely to the church, the New Testament presents the latter as the eschatological extension of the former. That which reaches all the way back to the divine creation of the first man and woman is seen to be further extended and explicated in the household of God, the church. Hence the requirements that an office holder manage his own household well and that he be faithful in marriage and keep his children under proper control all form the indispensable prerequisite for his suitability for church office. Before he can lead the household of God, he must first show that he can properly discharge his leadership responsibilities in his own household. But what shall we say about divorced men serving as pastor, elder, or deacon? In light of the fairly stringent statements made by both Jesus and Paul regarding divorce and remarriage, and in view of the fact that serving as pastor, elder, or deacon in the local church is a high calling of considerable responsibility, should men who have undergone a divorce be barred from serving in roles of church leadership, specifically those of pastor, elder, or deacon? In light of the high moral qualifications required for those serving in those offices, this would seem to be almost a foregone conclusion. How else would those in charge of a church model Christ-likeness to the rest of the congregation? In fact, for those who hold a no divorce, no remarriage position, several of my colleagues at Southeastern, and presumably some of you here, the question of whether a divorced man can serve in church leadership does not even arise. Divorce is never legitimate for any Christian, according to those people, including those aspiring to positions of leadership in the church, and especially for those. As such, a divorcee certainly could not be considered a faithful husband or above reproach. For those open, at least in principle, to the possibility that divorce may be biblically legitimate in a limited number of circumstances, Matthew 19:9, 1 Corinthians 7:15, however, the issue is not quite as clear-cut. The major passages dealing with qualifications for leadership, as mentioned, do not directly address this question, focusing instead on the requirement of a candidate's faithfulness in a present marriage. The issue therefore turns to a significant extent on the question of what is meant by the requirement of being a Mias Gynaikos on air, as mentioned. If, as has been argued, the expression means faithful husband, then it may be possible for men who experience a divorce to fulfill this requirement if they're faithful to their wife in their present marriage. Hence, divorced and remarried men would not necessarily be excluded from consideration as pastors, elders, or deacons, especially if, in keeping with the general principles of the majority view on marriage and divorce, divorce was legitimate, as in the exception clause in Matthew or the Pauline, so-called Pauline privilege. If the divorce was illegitimate, service as pastor, elder, or deacon would, of course, be ruled out because that person has an illegitimate divorce in their past, whether they repented of this sin or not. Overall, people should generally not be held to a stricter standard just to be safe, stricter than scriptural standard, that is, just to be safe and conservative. If, and not all agree, both Jesus and Paul were willing to make one exception, we should be willing to follow their lead without fearing that a high view of marriage will necessarily thereby be compromised. Nevertheless, when coupled with the requirement that an overseer be above reproach, which includes community reputation, it may be best in most circumstances to weigh very carefully whether or not to appoint divorced men to the role of pastor, elder, or deacon, especially when qualified candidates are available who did not undergo a divorce. This would seem to be the wisest course of action, especially since there are many other avenues of service available to people in those kinds of circumstances apart from the highest ecclesiastical office. Yet while the standard is one of spiritual maturity and moral uprightness, it is not that of perfection. In fact, the list contains many attributes to which every Christian should aspire. To be sure, pastors ought to set an example of spiritual maturity, but their role is not to be conceived as representing Christ in such a way as to literally embody his own characteristics, be it in his unmarried state, as incidentally Roman Catholics would hold, or in his lack of divorce or remarriage. More appropriately, those office holders who are married ought to model Christ's faithfulness to his spiritual bride, the church, by being faithful to their wife. This is fully compatible with the above-presented view that Paul requires marital faithfulness of office holders while leaving open the question of whether or not those who have undergone a divorce that is biblically permissible, if this is considered possible, are at least in principle eligible to serve. Requirements pertaining to church leaders' children. Paul's epistles to Timothy and Titus both include not only the faithful husband requirement, but also a stipulation regarding the church leader's children. To Timothy, the apostle writes that the candidate for office, quote, must manage his own household well, with all dignity, keeping his children submissive. 1 Timothy 3:4. In an argument from the lesser to the greater, Paul continues, for if someone does not know how to manage his own household, how will he care for God's church? 1 Timothy 3:5. The requirement mentioned in the epistle to Titus seems to be even stricter, stipulating that the church leader's children, reading from the ESV, that the church leader's children are believers and not open to the charge of debauchery or insubordination, Titus 1:6. The NIV here reads, whose children are faithful and not open to the charge of being wild and disobedient. Interestingly, the TNIV changed rendering to whose children believe. At least that would be one case where the TNIV, if anything, seems to have set a higher standard than the NIV. Again, Paul follows up with a reason for an overseer as God's steward must be above reproach, Titus 1:7. The Greek word underlying the rendering believers is pistos, which can mean either believing, as the ESV and the TNIV translated, or faithful, NIV. While believing, admittedly, is the word's meaning in the majority of instances in the pastorals, even though there's other instances where it does mean faithful, in the present case, it is perhaps more likely that the expression means faithful in the sense of obedient and submissive to their father's orders. Compare 1 Timothy 3:11, 2 Timothy 2:2, and 13. These things entrust to faithful men. The meaning believing is rendered less likely here, in my view, in light of the context and the parallel in 1 Timothy 3:4. Otherwise, you would have two different qualifications, somewhat more lenient in 1 Timothy 3:4 and a stricter one in Titus 1:6. Not to mention the theological difficulties of accommodating the doctrine of election within the scope of such a requirement. fathers and parents often typically do not have a control over whether or not a child is actually going to be converted or not. The fact that the other two instances of wild, Greek word is asotias, relate to orgies of drunkenness, in Ephesians 5:18, opposite of being filled with the Spirit, and in 1 Peter 4:4, and the other two instances of disobedient, literally the word unsubjected, unupotakta, also used in a similar word used in Hebrews 2:8, disobedient or even outright rebellion, 1 Timothy 1:9 and Titus 1:10, suggests that what is in view is not occasional disobedience, but deep-seated rebellion against parental authority. In other words, the other instances of those two words used in Titus 1:6, wild and disobedient, seem to be extreme cases of rebellion or insubordination, rather than referring to being regenerate. Anyone who would be an elder in the church, which entails the exercise of authority over the congregation, must properly exercise authority at home, with his children responding in obedience and submission, whether or not, my view, they are spiritually regenerate. This is required if God's manager, oikonomos Theou, is to be blameless. 1 Timothy 3:5 and 15. Second office, then, deacons. Second church office addressed in 1 Timothy 3, besides that of overseer elders, that of deacon. Similar reference also in Philippians 1:1. Structurally, the presence of hos autos, which means likewise, in both 1 Timothy 3:8, referring to male deacons, and then 1 Timothy 3:11, suggests that qualifications are given for two other types of office holders besides that of overseers. 1 Timothy 3:1 through 7. To put it differently, the framing device by which 1 Timothy 3:11 is sandwiched between 1 Timothy 3:8 and 10 and then 3:12 to 13 indicates that one large category seems to be in mind, that of deacon, with Paul first addressing qualifications for male and then female office holders, after which he briefly returns to male deacons and closes with a general statement pertaining to both. As mentioned, the two-tiered structure, elder-deacon, characteristic of 1 Timothy 3, is also evident from Philippians 1:1. When comparing the qualifications for deacons with those for overseers, one notes the absence of terms related to teaching or ruling, most notably able to teach, which is required of elders in 1 Timothy 3:2. See also 1 Timothy 3:5b. This suggests that in keeping with the designation deacon from the Greek diakonos, servant, as over against overseer, deacons are not part of that group that bears ultimate responsibility for the church. At the same time, they too occupy a formal church office for which they are recognized and must meet certain requirements. While not part of a teaching or ruling body of a church, deacons nonetheless hold important leadership roles. This is most notably indicated by the similarity between the qualifications of overseers and deacons. Although Paul does not spell out the precise realm of service for the office of deacon, one may surmise that this includes various kinds of practical help and administration, such as benevolence, finances, and physical maintenance, among others. According to 1 Timothy 3:8, deacons, likewise, are to meet certain qualifications, whereby 1 Timothy 3:8 through 10 and 12 relate to male, and 1 Timothy 3:11 to female office holders. There's no consensus as to the proper translation of the Greek word gynaikos in 1 Timothy 3:11, which can mean either woman or wife, since both meanings, woman and wife, are found in the present epistle. Context must decide. Of course, we know in some sense those women are related to deacons, be it in terms of being married to one or being deacons themselves. Depending on one's translation of this term, the office holder in view is either woman deacon or the wife of a deacon. Translations also are divided on this issue. In some cases, even the same translation committee has changed its view on the most likely rendering. The NIV, for example, translates gynaikos with their wives, though note that their is not in the original Greek, but the TNIV changes this to women who are deacons, that is, women deacons or deaconesses. Some translations committed to a formal equivalence translation philosophy, mentioned that a minute ago with the faithful husband requirement, such as the New American Standard and the Holman Christian Standard Bible, opt for the translation women, which has the virtue of being literal, but again, is of little help in deciding the issue, since the question still remains which kinds of women are in view, wives of deacons or women deacons. Time does not permit a full airing of all the arguments, pro and con. I have a bit more in this forthcoming pastoral's commentary in the New Expositor's Bible Commentary. I will limit myself to citing what I consider to be the most important exegetical factors that have a bearing on the issue. On the whole, it is my judgment that women deacons is to be preferred for the following reasons. Number one, the absence of qualifications for overseers' wives in 1 Timothy 3:1-7. So you would have the somewhat unusual situation to have qualifications listed for deacons' wives, but not overseers' wives. Secondly, the phrase in the same way in 1 Timothy 3:11 seems to indicate an office similar to the one previously mentioned in 1 Timothy 3:8, the same level, male deacons and female deacons respectively. Third, the parallel sentence structure and similar characteristics in 1 Timothy 3:8 and 11, including the lack of an article before women. And four, the absence of qualifiers such as the possessive pronoun there in relation to gynaikos in the Greek. The very fact that many translations feel compelled to add the word there, as in their wives, seems to be an indirect admission that to make sense of it in terms of deacons' wives, you do need to add that possessive pronoun, but the fact is that possessive pronoun is not there in the Greek, though it usually is when someone's wife is addressed, such as in the Ephesians 5 passage that we talked about yesterday. The reason that Paul did not call these women deaconesses may be that in his day the word diakonos was still used for males and females alike. For instance, Phoebe is called a diakonos in the masculine in Romans 16:1. Only later was the term diakonissa coined. Phoebe, as just mentioned, for instance, is identified as a diakonos of the church at Cenchrea in Romans 16:1. Paul's mention of women deacons would cohere well with his earlier prohibition of women serving in teaching or ruling functions over men, 1 Timothy 2:12, and his lack of mention of women elders in 1 Timothy 3:1-7. However, since being a deacon does not involve teaching or ruling, women as well as men would seem to be eligible to serve in this capacity, as long as elders and deacons, of course, are biblically defined in our churches. The requirement for deaconesses are thus similar to those for male deacons. Again, it should be noted that in recent years, the tide of opinion seems to have shifted somewhat toward the presence of women deacons in the early church, and hence also the possibility in the contemporary church. Until recently, most major translations, virtually all of them, took the reference in 1 Timothy 3:11 to be to the wives of deacons. King James and New King James have their wives. New American Standard and NRSV have women. NIV had their wives. And the New Living Translation also had their wives, usually acknowledging in the footnote that women deacons would be an alternative possibility. Thus, until recently, no major translation unequivocally affirmed in the main text that 1 Timothy 3:11 may refer to women deacons. And incidentally, it's always difficult if even if you favor women deacons, you are trying to explain that to a congregation when none of their Bibles actually reads that way. With the recent release of the TNIV, this has now changed, of course. As mentioned, it says women who are deacons. Also, interestingly, the Holman Christian Standard Bible, by opting for the word women, marks, it seems to me, a cautious departure from the King James traditional rendering of their wives. To this turning of the tide with regard to women deacons should be added the fact that several major recent commentaries written by complementarian scholars, no less, affirm the reference to Phoebe as a diakonos in Romans 16:1 should be interpreted as her serving as a deaconess. And the NIV, the TNIV, incidentally, also refers to Phoebe not as a servant, but as a deacon. The implications for the churches, and incidentally, I'm referring here to Thomas Schreiner's fine Romans commentary in the Baker Exegetical Commentary series, and also Douglas Moo's The Epistle to the Romans in the New International Commentary series, both complementarian scholars who favor rendering diakonos as deacon with regard to Phoebe in Romans 16:1. The implication for the church's contemporary practice seems to be that it may be only a matter of time until more churches may allow women to serve in the role of deaconess, of course, assuming a biblical definition of deacon as a non-teaching, non-ruling office. Already, several major churches pastored by those who are conservative on the issue of women pastors and elders have women deacons, including Grace Community Church, pastored by John MacArthur, and Capitol Hill Baptist Church, pastored by Mark Dever. And in preparation for this lecture, I went to the respective websites just to make sure, and in fact, in their constitution and also in their materials posted on the internet that is borne out. In any case, whether or not a church or a given scholar favors women deacons, in my view, should not be made a litmus test for orthodoxy or conservatism, since, as mentioned, the issue does cut across the conservative-liberal divide, and many pastors and scholars with impeccable credentials on the so-called women's issue both, on the one hand, limit the office of elder to men, and, on the other hand, open the office of deacon to men and women, such as Pastors Dever and MacArthur and others. Personally, as one who favors women deacons, but as one who's spoken out strongly against the women elders and pastors, the volume on women in the church that is now available in the second edition, I believe this is a good opportunity to show that we recognize the ministry of women just as we do the ministry of men. We're not against women in ministry, as our opponents sometimes allege, and that we do not discriminate against women involved in significant ministry. The unfortunate consequence, in my view, of limiting the office to wives of deacons is that this would exclude, and does exclude, unmarried women as well as widows. And this is unfortunate, since especially mature widows seem uniquely equipped to serve in such a role. In fact, there seems to be even some verbal parallels between 1 Timothy 3:11 and then Titus 2:3-5 and other passages. Conclusion, then. The pastorals reflect the two-tier structure of church government, with a plurality of pastors, elders, overseers in charge, and with deacons, both male and female, fulfilling serving roles in the church. The husband of one wife requirement most likely refers to the stipulation that church leaders be faithful to their wives. If so, those candidates for pastor or elder who are divorced but whose divorce is biblically legitimate and covered by one of the exceptions stipulated in New Testament teaching would not necessarily be disqualified from serving, even though I registered several cautions. I do not claim that these conclusions are the only ones possible from the New Testament data, nor do I claim that I'm necessarily right in all of my hermeneutical and exegetical judgments. There can be little disagreement, however, that the pastorals are one of the most important New Testament writings for the practice of the contemporary church, together with the book of Acts. The church must continue to wrestle with what Scripture teaches regarding church government, church leadership, and qualifications for leadership, and commit itself to abide by what it understands the Scriptures to teach, rather than personal preference or church tradition. I would also urge an awareness of one's own presuppositions and a willingness to revisit, or visit for the first time, the biblical data regarding, rather than following in the past of one's denominational forebears. It is with the Reformation commitment to sola scriptura, scripture alone, with the scholarly spirit of aut fontes, meaning going back to the primary sources, and with the dictum in essentials unity, in non-essentials liberty, and in all things charity, that I offer this modest contribution to our study and practice of the pastoral epistles. Thank you.